Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and it's going to be a fun one, Katie.
It is. We missed you last week.
I know. How'd it go without me?
It was terrible. We almost fell apart.
It's been known to happen. Yes. I'm glad you were able to persevere.
Yes.
All right. So we got today, we got Lamar Wakefield with Wakefield Beasley and Associates. Got Dave Ward with Tommy Nobis Center. And I got Han, the CEO and founder of IronCAD. And we're going to kick it off with Lamar Wakefield with Wakefield Beasley. Welcome, Lamar.
Thank you.
Lamar, can you share a little bit about Wakefield Beasley? How are you serving folks?
Well, we're a 38-year-old architectural interior design firm. We were acquired in January of this year by Nelson out of Philadelphia. We had five offices. They had 21, none of which were in the same cities, except for they had acquired Venadal Cave 3 or 4 years ago, an interiors firm in downtown. So it's a great platform for us, been able to leverage our diversity both in the practice that we do, which is all over the board from retail mixed use to office industrial, multifamily, land planning, obviously interiors, hospitality, and the other diversity component of our business here in Atlanta is we have 27 countries represented in our Atlanta office.
Wow. Now, can you talk a little bit about the beginnings? When you started the firm, it wasn't like you were Wakefield Beasley, right, at the beginning, days?
Right. So once you got out of architecture school, you had to work for as an apprentice for 3 years under a registered architect to be able to take a licensing exam, which at that point was given once a year. And I think it's online every day, so floodgates are open. Anyway, I passed the test, fortunately, the first time, and decided probably unwisely to start my own business out of my
just
apartment.
Just at a go. You just passed the test, and you're like, I can do this.
I can do it. Well, I grew up in Atlanta, knew a lot of people. You know, I had a lot of spunk, thought I was a great designer, so I can get this done. So I was working. My partner now, John Beasley, was actually my boss before. He's 8 years older than me. So after 4 or 5 months of being out on my own, we went fishing one Saturday, which we are wont to do, and it was all very friendly. And he said, "How's it going?" I said, "That's fine." He said, "I guess so. Everybody at the office is working for you at night." And I said, "Well, is that a problem? They need a little extra money too." So anyway, he wanted to know if I needed a partner, which was very flattering for me at the time because his experience in professional practice, contracts, insurance, that sort of thing was something I really needed. So that was 38 years ago in May. So it's been quite a run since.
So then you decided to team up?
Yes.
And he was he an architect or he was doing the business? So you were both architects?
Correct.
But you were kind of newer and he was more veteran?
He was a veteran. I was a kind of a business development design guy and he was in the house.
Doing the work guy.
Getting the
back
work
of the
out.
Room, and you were
correct.
The front of the
and
room.
And he loved it.
And then, but you had been friendly with him for years prior.
I had worked for him.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, so when you decided to do this venture on your together as opposed to on your own, did anything dramatically change in the business?
I think at the time it was really more survival as opposed to worrying about dramatic changes in the business. But we knew a lot of general contractors, and that really helped us. They brought us into a lot of opportunities on design-build basis as well as just introducing us to clients and knowing that we did quality work and were user-friendly to the general contractor community. It kind of got us kicked off.
Now, that's a good tip for people starting a business, right, is to be user-friendly. Can you talk a little bit about that concept of how the better you are serving your clients and serving their needs of these different constituents, that makes you more attractive to deal with, right? You're easier to work with.
Well hopefully. I mean, our culture is all about listening extremely carefully to the client. And even though we might think they're going in the wrong direction, we don't immediately tell them they're going in the wrong direction until we get the full story and the full backstory. Mm-hmm. And then as we move forward, we might say, you need to consider these two other options, and let me tell you why. But beyond that, it's client first. You know, I mean, obviously design is very important to us from a portfolio perspective and from a value creation. I mean, that's really important. We just finished the Avalon project you guys are aware of in Alpharetta. Mm-hmm. And after phase two, that project was sold to Prudential, the entire phase one and phase two through North American Properties. And other people were involved, Hines and Cousins and Jim Stormont. But it was a great team effort, all in great charrette design situations that produced a great product, which was the ULI National Deal of the Year at the time. So from where we started till now, it's still the same culture. It's about listening, being creative, working as hard as it takes to get the solution that the client's looking for, and you know, to help them create value in what they're trying to do.
And then, so in order to do that, you have to kind of have a holistic approach, or you have to understand exactly the outcome they desire in order to help them solve
that? Even beyond that, I would tell you that I took a deep dive, you know, 15 or 16 years ago into what the underwriting of these projects meant from a finance perspective, what the exit looks like, you know, what those exit cap rates mean. And so when we're designing to a budget, I'm looking at the pro forma from these folks and understanding that I see where they're headed. Not, you know, design is clearly important, but the budget is as well. So, you know, I think the Avalon example or the battery that we just did for the Braves are great examples of listening to the client, seeing the underwriting, and designing to it.
And then, like, when you take on a project like the battery where it has, you have a moving part of a baseball stadium, so that has its own kind of challenges and goals and outcomes. And then they tack on a mall, an outdoor shopping area, and then you have corporate office space, and mm-hmm. that's a lot of different kind of constituents that have different kind of objectives, right, individually, but you got to get them so they all are working together harmoniously.
Correct. I mean, it's all kind of, we told the Braves up front, it's not the 81 days a year you're playing baseball, it's the 284 days a year you're not playing baseball. That's important to see if this project's going to be successful. So if retail at that time, the ground level, street level experience was driving that. You know, the other components are so critical, because when the daytime shopper leaves and the office user leaves, the resident needs to be showing up, the hospitality guest needs to be showing up. We have to energize that space 14 to 16 hours a day, or the retail won't make it.
Right.
Food and beverage won't make it. It's not about leasing anymore. It's not about that. It's about merchandising space so that we create an opportunity to increase dwell time by promoting cross-shopping. So we merchandise it, so we promote cross-shopping, and that increases dwell time, and everybody wins.
And then what's dwell time mean for the layperson?
For the layperson, that means instead of just running into Walmart to pick something up and getting out of there as fast as you can, that you might walk down the street to enjoy a programmed event that's going on at the Battery or Avalon or any of these great mixed-use deals. You know, Atlantic Station, another one of our projects. There's something going on, whether it's, you know, a music scenario or a seasonal festival or an art show or whatever. You do those programmed events to increase dwell time so that after an hour or two, you actually do go to a food and beverage place and get a cup of coffee at least.
Right. So it's not just, well, how does that work, like, in city planning? Is there a place for this type of thinking in city planning? Because, like, my kid goes to school at Georgia State. Mm-hmm. Okay? So he's on campus downtown Atlanta. During the day, there's hustle and bustle. But, like, you know, 7 o'clock at night, it's a ghost town. There's no dwell time.
Right.
You know, the hours of active use are much smaller. Is there a place in city planning for this type of thinking?
Well, it's happening. When I was at school at Georgia Tech, Midtown was not the place to be. Nobody went to Midtown,
right,
unless you were looking for a certain couple of things.
Exactly.
Right?
That's still there.
Okay. But my point is, if you look at Midtown today, it is a there. It's mm-hmm. a place. And it's hopping at night. It's hopping on the weekends. There's residential, hospitality, office, retail, all the components. And, right, you know, being as close to Piedmont Park as it is, and then some of the other green spaces, you know, just like the lawn at Atlantic Station and how that gets programmed. I mean, last year, 350 events now all over the place. I mean, it could be yoga. It could be a big seasonal festival or a movie at night, whatever. You know, it's happening in city planning, and we're doing it on multiple small cities that want this play. They don't want to get in the car anymore and drive to
right.
Avalon. Holly Springs, Lilburn, Tucker, Lawrenceville, all these places want their own there.
Now, are you seeing, there's a lot of, especially in the Midtown area, you brought it up, there's a lot of these, the bikes and the scooters. Does mm-hmm. that help?
Oh, it's helping dramatically.
So you think that that type of initiative and these, I mean, these are now turning into billion-dollar companies, these kind of, you know, throw 500 bikes there and say, go at it.
Right. Even, you know, backing up, you know, to the when Uber was created mm-hmm. and what that does for all of us. I mean, the laws of drinking and driving clearly are appropriate.
Right.
And nobody at this table wants to get a DUI. So
right.
do I go to the Braves games? Of course I do. Do I Uber every time?
Every time. Right. Well, I just read something today. I just was in South Florida last week. The DUIs are down like 60% in South Florida.
Because of Lyft
because
and
of
Uber.
Those things.
Right.
I mean, it impacts the quality of life for everybody.
It does, clearly. It's great.
So now, for your firm now, you decided, I guess, to join another firm.
A much larger firm. Right.
So now, was that just kind of part of your, as you evolve as a leader, you're kind of exiting? Or is this something that you're saying, I'm going to take my firm to the next level?
It's for me, it's taking it to the next level. My partner, John's 8 years older, and he needed an exit.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't looking for these people. They just approached us. We'd been approached numerous times, actually. Just the cultures were so diverse that we weren't going to do it. But these guys have a culture similar to us, and it's all about that culture of client service and listening and great design as a result. So for me, I'm here for quite a while.
So now when you were kind of dreaming up this firm at the beginning, are the dreams coming true?
More than that. We never thought we'd have five offices and 250 people.
Now, when you're running kind of an organization this large, what are some of the lessons you learned about leadership?
Well, to us, I think the most important thing we did was craft responsibility positions for key people. So as in higher ed right now, Ina Bachman is our studio director. Karen Sickner is our studio director for criminal justice and municipal work. Lyndall Sherrill handles all of our institutional stuff, which might be assisted living, independent living, churches, so forth. Sasha Vanitsky handles office and industrial. Mike Lentz, retail mixed use, so forth and so on. There's other, Elizabeth Sessions, my partner, interior. So we empower them by letting them, and this is never, I've never seen this in another architectural firm, honestly, whereby if you're running the studio, we allow you to take 20% of the net profits yourself by running an efficient operation. And so we empower them, almost like 10 different little firms running ahead. And it's worked incredibly well for us.
So you create kind of an entrepreneurial kind of...
Very.
Where they have autonomy.
Right.
Responsibility, and they will be financially rewarded with their success.
In a big way, some years.
Right. So now, when you were starting out this concept, how did that kind of evolve?
Well, we already, people, you know, rise to the top of a certain studio type. If you're looking at a practice leader like Matt Mitchell, who runs our hospitality, he's had years and years of experience at HKS out of Dallas. He moved to Atlanta. We were fortunate to be able to get him, and so we knew his pedigree in hospitality. So we built a studio around Matt and said, Matt, I'll help you. Get involved in all of our mixed-use deals, and I'll help you market it, and we'll put the business development people behind your studio, as we do all of them, and let's grow this thing. And today we're probably doing 11 hotels currently.
So he's an employee, but he's kind of treated as a business owner.
Yeah, well, a lot of our studio leaders were also stockholders,
mm-hmm.
so that we think that's important as well.
So like an employee-owned environment?
Well, almost. I mean, John and I had the majority of the stock, but it was a good event for seven or eight people in our company who had been with us a long time. And you need to make that individual purchase the stock, even if it's over time, so they understand the value of it.
Right.
We sell it at a very good rate, and they it was a great event for those guys in January.
So now when you're recruiting new young architects, is the process the same where they have to apprentice and take the test and do all the stuff that you had to do?
It's all the same. They just give the test every day now.
now you can do it every day. And then are you finding that the younger generation of architects, are you bullish on the talent that you're getting?
It's unreal. Here's one thing. The reason we have so many countries in our Atlanta office is, you know, I would tell you 20 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, when we would go to these job fairs around the country, whether it was Tulane, University of Michigan, University of Virginia, wherever.
You weren't exclusive Georgia Tech,
No. We went all over the country. We want to get the best kids we could get. Here's the deal 20 years ago. Over half the kids graduating in architecture in America were not Americans.
Really?
Yeah. They cared this much about football, and they made straight A's. Okay? So that's who the best talent was. So because of that, you know, if you go into our design studio today that's headed up by Roberto Valdez from Mexico City, we have a couple of kids from Colombia, Zambia, Cairo, India, Venezuela. We don't have a single – now, they're all American citizens today.
Right.
But we don't have a single American-born person in our design group. Is that cool? It's awesome.
Right.
Because you get all these different ideas from around the world.
Right, from their background of growing up or wherever they did.
Right.
So then their kind of perspective is totally different.
It is.
So now, because of that, you probably have a design-wise more innovation.
Very much so. Very much.
Now, when you're working with clients, are they happy that that's the case, or is that a unique selling point for your firm?
They tease me about it. They call it NATO.
but there's some, I mean, there's true benefits there.
Absolutely.
Right?
They love it.
Because people just want the solution to work, right? They don't care.
The head of office industrial, Sasha Vinitsky, he's from Russia. And his lead office guy is Kunal Sahu from India. So we embrace that.
Now, you mentioned different
diversity.
Sectors that you work in. Is there sharing of ideas across sectors? Like, do you have kind of big, like if you're working on a big project like the battery, do you bring everybody in?
Everybody's in.
You got the hospitality person, you got the justice person, you got everybody in the room and say, okay, this is what we got in front of us here.
Hopefully not too much justice.
Right, less justice. You need some. We had Dave Justice was with the Braves for a long time.
Different. But, yeah, you know, our hospitality, multifamily, studio director, all the retail mixed use folks and our office people and interiors are in that room.
Now, are you seeing any innovation in some of the sectors that maybe historically was more of a status quo type that everything kind of looked the same and you're seeing some kind of a refresh or reboot in some of these different areas?
Well, you know, the automated drafting side of things is so different today from, I mean, when we first started the business at 30, we were drawing with lead, right, on Mylar. So, I mean, it's grown a little. It's evolved dramatically. But this Revit product and BIM, and it's changing so fast, and it's so efficient and very, very good. And so the quality of our renderings is an example. The big animation we did for the Braves to announce the battery, you know, we flew, got permission to fly a drone over the site. There was nothing there but dirt and trees, and then we were able to take the whole Revit model and stick it into the drone video and show fireworks at the end like we'd won the game. It was an amazing.
And then how accurate when it finished?
It was pretty dang close.
It's kind of scary, huh?
Yeah.
Now, and the modeling and the technology has changed to the point where in some large buildings you can model things that could never have been done manually, right? That they can do some computer modeling. Like I saw, like there's swimming pools sticking out of the sides of buildings where I'm sure back in the day it would have been hard to.
Very difficult. I mean, one thing about this modeling today, I mean, from the general construction perspective especially, there's no such thing as estimating anymore. Mm-hmm. If you want to know how many brick are on a building, it'll tell you exactly how many brick are on the building, how many doors, how much hardware, door frames, whatever. So it's changed the industry dramatically and made it much more efficient, but you just have to be tech savvy and stay on top of the latest trends. We do that. We actually teach Revit BIM classes at our office, and other architects come to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, for you, in these kind of the growth of these live, work, play environments, which obviously you guys are very active in, is that a trend that's happening all over the country now?
It is. We're doing, you know, Avalon-type projects in Frisco, Texas, Oklahoma City, Nashville, Charleston, Sayreville, New Jersey, Chicago, Miami, Cary, North Carolina. It's amazing.
So small, large, any size.
And they're all coming to our office, and this is what we want. In a lot of cases, I mean, Mark Toro and I helped put together this thing we call the secret sauce presentation, which tells you the 20 ingredients that you need to have to make one of these things successful. And the very first one is demographics. Mm-hmm. So it's got to have a 3-5 mile radius, be able to attract the right kind of tenants. Now, you might say, we don't want Anthropologie, Lululemon, Athleta, Kate Spade in our deal. We want all local tenants. Well, then we can put this thing anywhere except for you got to finance it, and local tenants don't have any credit. So, generally speaking,
right.
So it's a difficult process.
Also. Well, in the Battery, you have a lot of restaurants or local restaurants who didn't.
Well, it's once again, you know, do you have the demographic that's going to support a Ford Fry restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from Vining's, Galleria, Northside, absolutely, you have it. And if we put Ford up in Waleska, Georgia, would he succeed there? You know, that's a big question mark, right?
Right.
So it's a big risk for the developer, because what happens is, in each case, and I don't blame the quote, celebrity chef from doing this, but they form a shell LLC to sign the lease. We give them $180 a foot, and if they go out of business, we own it, right?
Right.
So at Avalon, it all was, you know, the North American folks were nervous about it, but I knew that demographic would support all of those chefs, Giovanni De Palma, Ford, Steve Palmer, all those guys that came.
Right. You got the Antico folks.
We
right?
do.
And now, what other are there? Is Atlanta kind of oversaturated now, or are you looking? You have to almost look to other markets now, or it seems like.
Well, a little bit. You know, we all have to worry about, you know, are we in overtime in this cycle, right? Or are we in the, you know, to me, we're like in the fifth or sixth inning in office. I think we're in overtime in multifamily, right? Retail has got its own platforms now, and so. Whoever's buying for a particular retail from season to season has their retailer's future in their hands, literally.
Right.
And so you see the stocks go up and down depending on seasonal sales. So brick and mortar is still important, and I think most of these retailers are understanding I've got to get on the Amazon platform. And that still drives brick and mortar, by the way. Amazon does. It does.
Right. But, and that's the thing that people, I mean, we talk all the time about that here, is that online sales is only like 10-15% of sales. It's
right.
still most, the vast majority of people are going into brick and mortar stores to
they
buy
are.
Stuff.
They're smaller now.
Right.
And that's fine. That's a direct result. Are they 15% smaller? I'd say they're every bit of that, maybe 25% smaller as far as the footprint goes. But... You know, retail is extremely dynamic, whereas office seems to be not so dynamic. You know, like this space that we're in here, Spaces, we interviewed for this assignment 10 years ago. We've done 1,500 spaces around the country.
Right.
Our interiors group has. It's a great concept.
Right. And it's that kind of following the WeWork of the
yes.
industry.
Well, Spaces was
WeWork.
Regis. Right,
Regis. Well, Regis is Spaces. Regis owns
Correct.
Spaces.
Correct. It's a lot older than WeWork is.
Right, and WeWork, but it's creating this open office
right.
environment that's kind of
co-working.
Co-working.
Yeah.
And you're seeing more of that, right? That's
oh,
now
absolutely.
Built into every building. I
and
would
not
imagine.
Not only built into everybody's offices themselves, their corporate
within
offices.
within
right.
the building, are going to this type of design, and then that's a that was kind of a it's one of those. Gradually, then suddenly, kind of situations, right? There was a sprinkling of it. Then it seems like it's everywhere.
It went everywhere.
Is you know, that what you were finding?
Yeah, you know, like Rome was another one.
Right.
That's
and that's a local.
That's Peyton Day's group, right?
Right.
So, I see it as a strong trend. I mean, we've got to, you know, understand how office is evolving and how people can be most efficient. I mean. It's kind of like Hines and Cousins building the office building 8,000 at Avalon spec 100%, and I'm looking at the underwriting and it's $38.50 a foot is the rate, and the market in Alpharetta is $25. How does that work? Well, it's 100% leased.
Wow.
Because people want to recruit and retain the finest kids. Period. That's what they and there were the cost of you be your office space versus getting the best kids. It's not even close.
But is it a situation where that they're taking smaller space because so many people are working virtually?
A lot of virtual work.
And so the space that they do take, they can really kind of trick it out and make it as nice as it possibly can
be. As nice as they can, and we encourage virtual work in mm-hmm. our office.
All right. So now, what's the pain that somebody's having where Wakefield Beasley and Associates is the answer? What's their challenge? Are they're thinking of developing something and they need an architect that's going to give them a real kind of diversity of thought and super surface service?
And we've got great planning. You know, so from our perspective, if we can help the client get the entitlements, which is where the value is created, going mm-hmm. through the zoning process, we do that all the time. And we create animation and fly through videos to show whoever the planning staff and or commissioners or council people, whoever you're dealing with, what this really is going to be.
Right, and so they can get on board and really support it.
Get on board, right.
And then if somebody wants to learn more, what's the website for you guys?
It's www.wakefieldbeasley.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Yes, sir. Appreciate that.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, I got Dave Ward with the Tommy Nobis Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did you learn anything there? Lamar's a pretty sharp guy, right?
Yeah, he sure is. I just learn about business and how that works, retail, work life, all
That's
that.
That's right. So now, Dave, can you share a little bit about Tommy Nobis? How are you serving folks?
Yeah, so we serve people with disabilities, and what we do is we help them find meaningful careers, meaningful employment. We've been in this market for over 41 years, and of course, started by the great Mr. Falcon Tommy Nobis.
That's right. Way back in the day. Was he original Atlanta Falcon?
Absolutely. He was the first draft pick ever by the Atlanta Falcons.
And then he put together this. Was this going on while he was having his career? He started this? Or?
No, he was a part of it right from the beginning. Bobby Knopf, who was a special education teacher, is one of our founders. And Joyce Slaughter, who had a daughter with a disability, is also one of our founders. And Joyce, her daughter was getting ready to graduate, and there were no options for her. What happens next? You're 18, you're 19 years old, you're graduating. There's no place for her daughter to go train, to go find job skills. So Bobby Knopf and Joyce came together and said, you know what, let's approach Mr. Falcon Tommy Nobis, see if he'll lend
he'll
his
fix
name.
This.
Yeah, right, right. And Tommy was completely open to it. He was involved with Special Olympics back in the day.
Right.
And Tommy said, absolutely, let's do this.
And then it started there, and now it's evolved. You have offices around the city, right? Or do you have one location?
Well, we have one headquarters of the mothership, if you want to say, which is Marietta. But we actually...
Because I thought I saw a center downtown.
Well, we provide and fulfill government contracts as well. So mm-hmm. we're at EPA, CDC, and a variety of different places around the country in 19 states fulfilling government contracts.
And then, so what is kind of the way that this all works? So I have a child maybe with special needs or some disability. I can contact you and you can help train
Absolutely.
In place.
Yeah. A lot of our referrals come through Georgia Vocational Rehabilitation Agency. Mm-hmm. And folks qualify for services there. And then GVRA will make the referral to us here locally. And then we'll engage with the client and meet them wherever they're at with whatever their needs are. Don't provide them too much. Don't provide them too little. Just meet them where they are and help them get a job.
And then you do training and as far along as to even transporting sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. We can help with transportation and or even transportation training. Someone mm-hmm. wants to use, as you mentioned earlier, Uber or Lyft, those kinds of things. Let's say they don't have their driver's license, but it's a cheap, affordable way to get to work. Because mm-hmm. transportation is a real barrier for
right.
folks with disabilities to get jobs.
And then you actually have centers where the workers go to do some work as
we
well,
do.
Right?
We do. We have about a 65,000-square-foot building. About 45,000 is warehouse space. So we have a lot of individual contracts we fulfill with Wellstar and a variety of other businesses. But then also we have community partners like Kroger, Owens & Minor. We just finished up a job with Andretti's where we're doing janitorial work. We're working with Kroger. We're doing a lot of the retail work there as well. And they're training opportunities just to bring somebody along one step closer to getting that job.
So now, walk us through if there's a company out there that might be able to leverage some of your services. So how does that work?
Yeah, you know, sometimes we're referred to as a staffing agency because we have great talent. And, of course, companies have great needs for great talent. So mm-hmm. we'll train a client up or a program participant up, and we have employment placement specialists, and their job is to help these folks get the job. So anywhere from helping them develop their resume to do mock interview skills to personal social adjustment training in the classroom, which is a variety of different things to help someone get that job.
Now, if the company wants to work with the Tommy Nobis folks, you're working with the Tommy Nobis folks, not that individual person, or like you're the go-between?
Both. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we believe in providing training where actually someone's going to get the job. So let's talk about Kroger for a minute. So we send a crew of folks with disabilities, 5 to 7 on any given day, to work in a Kroger where they're going to stock shelves. They're going to do some cleaning. They'll do some front-end bagging, those types of things. And we'll have a training supervisor there. And that person's job is to make sure the job gets done. So we're providing a real service. We do it in pretty affordably. And it's a win-win for Kroger. It's a win-win for our job participants.
But it's kind of a turnkey solution for the firm, right?
It is. It is. And that's a community training site. But then, you know, like our government contracts and or our commercial contracts, we'll go and let's say we bid on cleaning this building. Mm-hmm. Just like any other for-profit, we would put in a price, might hire 10 people to come work on this work crew to clean this building in the after hours. That would be a commercial contract which we would execute and fulfill, make sure the job gets done.
So now, recently you were named best and brightest place to work.
Yeah, we're one of Atlanta's best and brightest places to work for the second year in a row. And I'm a firm believer in culture and building culture. And really, I focus on two things every day, and that's mission and people. Every decision I make is going to be what's best for the people that we serve. And, of course, when you invest in your teammates, as you were talking about in the last interview, you know, pulling in a great variety of different folks from different arenas, different spaces, different experiences. You reward them for hard work, provide clarity, transparency. Everybody's winning then.
Now, can you talk a little bit about your background? How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I have been in the line of service or nonprofit work for 29 years. I moved here 3 years ago to take on this role as CEO for Tommy Noble Center. I was at the Wounded Warrior Project for 5 years before that, and I went to Wounded Warrior Project at a time. I was the 30th person hired there. Within 5 years, we grew by $200 million and grew by about 400 staff. So I was able to be a part of some tremendous growth. And, of course, that was when times were pretty tough in this country for business. Yeah.
So now what drew you to the mission of Tommy Nobis?
Well, the mission itself, empowering people through employment. I will always be in service. I want to leave this place, this world, better than when I came into it. And I'm driven by making an impact. And whatever that means, whether it's with the people we serve or whether it's with my teammates, just want to try to make a difference.
So now, for the people who aren't familiar and have children that are maybe would need this service at some point, how does can they get involved as youths, or is this only come into play after they're kind of an adult?
No, we have a brand new program called EYES, and that stands for Early Youth Employment Services. So now we're going into the school systems, and we'll meet with kids, work with kids, teach kids ages 14 to 16 in their classrooms, focusing on pre-employment training. And essentially it's talking about different careers, whether it's in architecture, whether it's in software design, or whatever it is, and really exposing them to what careers look like, what you need to do for schooling to get these types of jobs. And we firmly believe if you can get to kids sooner, educate them sooner, educate the parents sooner, then they're just going to be that much more employable when it comes time to go to work.
Now, if a company, maybe they can't even imagine how this could work, aren't you open to having conversation with them to kind of brainstorm and explore ways that that this service? Because I would imagine there's lots and lots of companies could leverage the kind of the workforce that you have at your disposal, and that would help a lot of people. But it's not even in their radar that they think that, this is
that's
viable.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. One thing we're really focusing on this year, we just kicked off our fiscal year in July, it's sharing with people, educating people on our capabilities or our abilities as an organization, not just the people we serve and their amazing abilities, but the Tommy Nobis Center and all the things we can do. As I mentioned, the government contracts, the commercial contracts, the community sites, all kinds of things.
So now what are some of the kind of services that your workforce can do that maybe aren't obvious or kind of intuitive for business owners?
You know, we have folks that come to us with their master's degree, and we just recently placed someone at Comcast in their marketing department. And we've got folks with their GEDs who work their tails off, quite honestly, come to work with a smile. They're happy to have a job. But as I mentioned, our government contracts, so the CDC, we handle their mailroom services. And you can imagine the CDC, there's some interesting things that come through the mail. The high level of training, you know,
right.
A suspicious package, you've got to go through all the right protocol.
Right.
And on all of our contracts, more than 75% of the people that work on these contracts have disabilities. And Tommy Nobis Center in general, we have 150 staff. More than 75% of all of our staff have a disability.
And then, so now, if you have a disability, could the disability mean that they have to be at their house and they can only do work virtually? Or is it something where they have to travel and go to the location?
Most of the folks we work with want to go out in the community and work. But mm-hmm. certainly, as was mentioned earlier as well, supporting working from home or working remotely. You know, when I worked with folks, more so at Wounded Warrior Project with PTSD, they don't want to go into work. They mm-hmm. don't want to be around people. But, boy, they can crank out the work at home, crank out the work remotely. So, again, it's meeting the person where they are, what they want to do, and then we'll get creative with helping them get there.
And for you, what's your vision going forward for Tommy Nobis?
We want to make sure everybody gets served, you know, regardless of where they live, regardless of how tough it is trying to navigate the world of services. We want to work with our great partners like Bobby Dodd and Goodwill to make sure that this entire region's covered with anybody that wants services can receive the services.
Can you share a little bit about the numbers? How many people are there out there that you guys are working with, and how many? What's kind of the need?
Yeah, we're going to serve over 1,000 people this year out of our Marriott office. As I mentioned, 75% of our entire workforce of 150 have disabilities. So we support them on an ongoing basis to help them be successful as well. But there are a lot more people out there with disabilities that people don't realize or don't want to admit that are out there. A lot of folks in the disabilities world, out of sight, out of mind, you know. And I've worked with kids organizations. I've worked with Make-A-Wish Foundation and Big Brothers. And those are, you could say, more attractive. They're easier to fund. But people with disabilities, they just want to have a chance. They want to have that job.
Because what happens if they're not affiliated with you? Do they just stay at their parents? Like, what's their life look like?
They're going to be playing games at home. They're going to be sitting on the couch. They're not going to have any sense of purpose, any sense of meaning to get up. They're probably going to be overweight or unhealthy because they're not physically active. And, you know, what's their sense of purpose if they don't have a reason to get up in the morning except to play video games? And this is something we try to work with the parents on as well, educating them that in our early youth employment services and or before these folks turn 18 and they're getting ready to finish school, what's the plan? Let's get in front of this. Let's get them trained right now so they can hit the ground running when they're ready to work.
And then there's thousands of people out there
thousands of people all over the country, absolutely. And, you know, we're talking about technology earlier and just how the industry's changed. You know, identifying somebody with, let's say, on the autism spectrum, you can do that earlier, and you can get intervention earlier, and they can work themselves out of that arena and become much more social, become much more successful in the community as well. So, you know, technology and just the ability to identify it and work through it, educational piece, it's strong.
So on one hand, you're working very closely with these business owners to help create a solution for them, but you're also working just as hard from the other side with the parents to help the kids have a future with a purpose.
That's exactly right. So we're working with our business partners, we're working with our program participants, we're working to educate the parents, and quite honestly, you know, lots of business owners and so forth as well. Again, sharing our abilities and our capabilities.
Now, I know you've only been with Tommy Nobis for a few years, but do you have any memorable story you can share of a kind of an impact you made with somebody?
That I've made with somebody?
Or your firm has
made
on your watch?
What I got to do last week. Got a guy, Steven, that we work with, who was named the Mid-South Region Employee of the Year by Red Lobster. So they rolled out the red carpet. They flew him to Las Vegas. And Steven's never been outside Atlanta. He went to Alabama. He's never been never been on an airplane, but certainly been to Las Vegas. So I accompanied him there. You know, he doesn't read or write, but yet he's independent, lives on his own, drives a moped to work to get there on time. So I accompanied Steven to Las Vegas to make sure he could get his suit, his tie on, to make sure he was where he needed to be. They rolled out the red carpet. He went to a huge event where there were over 1,000 Red Lobster employees there. And he was the star. He was a VIP.
And then so this is somebody that came through the ranks at Tommy Nobis?
Yeah, he came to us as a program participant, and we trained him, helped him a variety of different ways from his resume, just from his confidence as well. Mm-hmm. And they love him at Red Lobster. He does anything they ask him to do, and he's just a team player. He lifts the spirits of the team there is what they've described.
And then so he works at a local Red Lobster?
He does, yeah, in Powder Springs.
Uh-huh. And then so that's you work with a lot of restaurants. So like what industries are kind of a sweet spot?
All of them. I mean, certainly retail, janitorial space, but again, mailroom, administrative services as well. It's just a variety. Again, it just depends on the abilities or the skill sets or the desires of the folks we're working with.
So now if somebody wanted to learn more, what if you're a parent of a child or if you're a business owner, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
To go to our website at www.tommynobiscenter.org. And there's pages and information for somebody that owns a business or works in a business, wants to hire our talent, to program participant, to parents, to all the information's right there.
Good stuff, Dave. Well, thank you for doing what you're doing. It's such important work, and the impact you're having in the community is you should be very proud. You sleep well at night, I'm sure.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to do what I do.
Well, thank you. Hang with us. Got one more guest. I got Han with Iron CAD. Welcome, Han.
Thank you.
So how about you? That's a good show for you, huh? You got architects, you got a service, community service.
Yeah, it's very interesting the story because whether architecture or this nonprofit, it's kind of, I have the structural engineering background, so I kind of, not having the artistic part of the architecture, but also have been personally involved in some nonprofit things. So it all sounds very interesting to me.
So tell us about IronCAD.
Yeah, IronCAD is really an innovation company. We provide a design and a solution for manufacturing companies in a worldwide market. So IronCAD was actually, it's a long story. It was originally founded by two Cornell University professors. So I was one of the first employee. Then it gone through quite a few investment, merger and acquisition. Finally, I spun off and co-founded IronCAD in 2001.
And then who is your typical customer?
Our customer mostly in manufacturing industry, and more our solution is much strong in that equipment, machinery design, modular product design, and like a metal fabrication. So mostly all in mechanical engineering.
And they have customers all over the world?
Yes, we have the worldwide customer. We sell our solutions through distributors, and we have about 50 distributors worldwide.
So now, isn't that a pretty competitive market?
It is. It's very saturated, very competitive market called computer-aided design market. There's four major players. They are all kind of multi-billion-dollar company. We are relatively very small, but we manage to keep growing our business.
So now, what makes you different?
Yeah, because our technology are fundamentally different because we always, from the bottom of our mind, we always believe there's a better way. So we don't just follow this big player's way, how they offer the solution to the customer. Give you one example, like in the design, those computer-aided design, you kind of on the computer in a virtual world to simulate and design like a geometric shape of your product, your engine, your cell phone, your TV. So most of the other CAD, they start with like what's so-called a two-dimensional sketch. So
right.
Typically, you need engineering training to figure out what's the profile. Your architecture definitely knows that. But we want to produce a more intuitive way. So we are living a three-dimensional world. So our technology will do design directly using 3D.
So it starts at 3D.
Start in 3D, like every kid probably play Lego.
Right.
You can consider IronCAD design system is a Lego-based. But our kind of this element, our Lego element is much more powerful because every element, you can change its shape, its size, and when you put this Lego piece together, in the real Lego, you're just adding then assemble them. But in our case, you can put this piece together, not just adding together, you can use one piece, subtract the volume of the other piece, or do the intersection. In addition, we can build in some intelligence into this piece, into an electronic catalog. So when you're using the software, you drag and drop these pieces. When you put together like this this bottle, there's a cap. You just drop the cap anywhere on the bottle. But you know the cap has to go there. So
right.
Why bother? The system automatically put it there and get the right size. So by that way, the software become much easier to use. And typically, you can get job done with a half time.
So it takes much less time.
Much less time. That's one major differentiation. Another thing is like we want our software, because we're an innovation company, right?
Right.
We want our customer also be able to do very creative design, not just using a software, but you already have the design in your mind, then you just put it into a virtual world. But we want them can explore what if, very creatively. So we don't put a restriction just because the software system doing so. We won't let the designer do whatever design change they wanted. Typically, in a product life cycle, many times, even in the architectural, in a machine design, in a late stage, your client or your customer in the supply chain wants to say, hey, I want to change it because my environment changed. I want to change the design. All these are coming unexpected. So, but our system allow you to do very flexible change at very late stage, but not worry about that may have an impact to your whole design.
So then all the ramifications of that change are able to be tracked through the software?
Yes. Yeah, the software. Today, the mainstream, people call this a feature-based parametric design. That's what most of the computer-aided design software does. So we support full-blown of that capability. But also another way people call direct modeling. Forget about the history. If I want to change the geometry, I just go ahead, do that change. So
like you mentioned in that bottle, the bottle right now, the top of the cap is at the top. If I want the cap on the side, mm-hmm. I could just move it to the side.
Yes.
And then it would just make it so it worked.
Right. You should move it to the side. Then, of course, then you on the side, you have to open a hole for that.
But then it's doing all that part, though.
Yes. It allowed the designer to do so.
Right. So now, for you, how do you see this evolving?
Computer-aided design is originally mostly used by the designer. But nowadays, designer cannot just do their work in a dark room. So at the front end, they need to talk to the sales guy, marketing guy, and even to the customer directly. On the back end, your design, if cannot be manufactured, is useless, right? So it has to be talking to the manufacturing process. So actually, we see a much better opportunity for us is because the tightly integration between the design software and the manufacturing process. So recently, we had a few successes. We have a built-in robot simulation. This is the trend, people talking about industrial 4.0 smart manufacturing. But the base to enable that is automation. If you don't automate your manufacturing process, you won't be able to get such benefit. So we're talking about bringing the manufacturing back to the United States. And you need automation to do that. So with our very intuitive way, like the built-in robot simulation, we have quite good success. Besides the CAD business, step into the factory automation.
Wow. So is there things in the wild that you actually are using the software in that environment?
Yes, absolutely. I give you two examples. One example is a large automobile component manufacturing company, multi-billion-dollar company. They were using robot, of course, in their production line. So this is not a real new idea. You have to simulate your product process, like your robot arm, how they move, they don't collide into other. And do the simulation, you need a software. But typically, people have a design software, has a simulation software.
So it's all separate.
Separate.
Yours brings it all together.
In a single one. And also, it become much more productive and much more cost effective.
Because then now they just need one software that can do work on all elements of this.
Right. And also set up that it become much faster. That's very critical. Because nowadays, the market more demand the custom requirement product.
Right.
So it's no longer I calibrate with production line. You can do the sensing running for a year. Maybe this week you're doing this product. Next week you're doing another one.
Right, totally different.
You need to adjust your production line from A to B in a very fast way. Okay. Yeah, another success example is we work with, another multi-billion-dollar company in their robot manufacturing division. So they bundle our solutions simulation. So when they sell their robot, they bundle with software, has more value to their customer.
So now, how come it's based here in Atlanta?
That's another interesting story. We started, because it was founded by Cornell University, we started in Ithaca, New York. So then when we have our own product, we say we need to find a place that's it's an airline hub. When we need to do the customer meeting, uh-huh. It's much convenient. And Atlanta is Delta,
right.
The center, and we have a good talent pool, Georgia Tech, and also the operational cost comparing to this software-centric city is much more affordable.
So now, are you enjoying the, has it been fruitful for you working here in Atlanta?
Yes, I definitely like Atlanta. Nice, especially so many green trees. It's so nice. Yes.
So now, what about from an attracting talent standpoint? Are you able to get the talent you need?
It's getting very competitive, but at least Atlanta, we have Georgia Tech here, Georgia State, Emory. So we have a good school here. But still, the demand is high, so it's very competitive. I was just talking to Dave. We've been looking for two high-quality developers for 6 months. So far, we only got one.
So how do you go about finding them?
We talk to school. We go to school. Mostly, we talk to school, see if for this graduate, we have an intern program, hopefully attracting in the early stage. Also, by referral is another right. way. Because we have, talking about this nonprofit, we try to get back to the community. So we've been working with Georgia Tech to participate in this STEM program, science, right. technology, engineering, and the mathematics. So we've been donating our design software as well as give training for, in Georgia State, probably more than 100, 200 middle school already.
Wow.
So we want the student learn, like you said.
So you want to start young, right?
Yeah, not only the primary want our kids at school, they know what's the real thing happening in the industry. And then when they're coming out of school, they know what's the real world. That's not the primary purpose. But, of course, we put the seeding in there. Once right. they know our system, they know that it's a good system, we got the opportunity too.
Now, do you work with the women in technology folks?
Yes, yes. Actually, my co-founder is a female, and she been actively participating in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. Every month they come in here and talk about their work.
Right, right. Actually, just last week I was in there's a Georgia Manufacturing Association,
right.
and there's a group they come in with a female engineer or female business owner, as well as interesting is a group helping the veteran to reestablish after retire.
Right.
So we kind of talking about helping them also donate our software training for those people need it, but when they qualify, so they can get an easy way to re-establish their...
And that way they can learn on the software, and that way they can be ready
right.
to help.
Right. They can do their own consulting business. So very similar to what Dave's
right.
group does.
Good stuff. Well, what do you need more of right now? How can we help you?
See, what we know is we need people know about us, give us a chance. Because many times when we get a chance to go talking to a company, and in the engineering group who are actually needing to use the software, usually we're standing out because we
right.
are really good technology. But usually it's people don't know us, so we don't even have the chance to show
right,
them.
Right, because they go with one of the big...
The big brand. One, right.
right.
Another challenge is many times we're facing is even the who actually want to use the solution say, IronCAD is the most productive one. But then the final decision of purchasing still not go to us because some big corporations, they prefer the brand name instead
right.
of the price performance.
Right. So do you have a sweet spot of size of company that tends to embrace your...
Yes. Most of all, current customer are small in the medium business. Mm-hmm. So ranging from several million dollars to probably less than $100 million. But also we have some big corporation, but relatively less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but the more important is that our sweet spot is, as I mentioned earlier, it's like a equipment, machinery, and a modular product and assembly, metal fabrication. So certain area, we absolutely more productive by far.
So if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Our website, www.ironcad.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.